Paul George, his first shot is good.
He just kind of threw that one at the rim.
And it was vintage Paul George.
The final decade the Pacers will be honoring is the one they're currently in. I'm Pat Boylan. With us to talk about it is Pacers television voice Chris Denary. Chris, I want to start with 2009-2010. The Pacers go into this season having three straight years not making the playoffs. That's an extended period for what the franchise had been experiencing. And 29-2010, that was the case as well. The Pacers go 32-50. I want to start bigger picture. You go through those four seasons. Would it have been a completely wild thought at that point to know the fact that in just a couple of seasons they would be challenging the Miami Heat for the East Best Team? They would be going through the kind of runs that they did just a couple seasons later?
No question about that, Pat. And when you when I look at the media guide, I see a lot of L's, and I'm holding the media guide with 2009-2010, and a 32-50 record, a team that really struggled, a team that had some young personnel, a Roy Hibbert, but also had some veterans. It's a little bit hard to believe that just a few years later you would play LeBron James and the Miami Heat in not one, not two, but three playoff series that I think epitomized, Pacers basketball to, in the middle of the decade. So those first 4 years that I was a broadcaster, including the final year, 09-10, of those four straight losing seasons, yeah, that was tough to watch because it was a struggle. The Pacers were languishing near the bottom of not just the Central Division, but the Eastern Conference. But you were hoping that there would be brighter days ahead, and you were hoping they'd be sooner rather than later.
One thing I think many people might forget about that season, they go 32-50, but they actually closed the season at 10-4. And I remember some people worrying that all of a sudden that took them out of drafting the kind of franchise-changing player that the Pacers maybe were hoping for that next season. So they finished 10-4 to get to 32-50. And of course, the irony then being, yes, they move back, but it ends up being the draft where they end up selecting Paul George. What were your memories of initially selecting him? Because if I remember correctly, of course, he comes just 1 year from a part of the country and not a huge basketball conference and program at Fresno State. There were a lot of unknowns, especially for a guy that was drafted that high.
Well, and we know that right before him taken was Butler standout Gordon Hayward, who had just helped lead Butler to the national championship game at Lucas Oil Stadium. And you're right, you just don't see a lot of Fresno State basketball in the Eastern time zone. So, back then, the highlight really of the season, Pat, was the draft night, because that's when you brought all of the season ticket holders together because you were trying to sell hope. Hope that this franchise would turn around and not have four straight non-playoff seasons, because we know how successful the seasons were starting in the mid-90s all the way to the mid-2000s. They had been in the playoffs 16 out of 17 years. And so I remember standing up on the stage when we got word, and I had watched some of the pre-draft workouts and was impressed with what I'd heard about Paul George, but I didn't know much about Paul, and nobody in that building at Bankers Life Fieldhouse knew much about Paul George. And I think when I got up there and announced to the crowd that the Pacers, with their pick, the 10th overall pick, had taken Paul George, a lot of people were confused. Here's a guy with two first names, if you will, that nobody had ever heard of. But I think, as we all know now, looking back, the great development of Paul George into the pro that he's become, and that turned out to be really a huge selection for the franchise. And, Larry Bird and company, they did their homework. They felt that Paul would be a better pro than he was a college player, and I think we all know that's what's happened.
Lance Stephenson comes in that draft as well. I remember personally, it was before I was with the Pacers and I was interning at Channel 6. And we were there for an early summer workout session with Paul. And I just happened to be standing in the practice gym and in the corner. And of course, he doesn't know who I am. And he kind of looks at me and he goes, "Hey, watch this." And he's shooting threes from the corner. And his next shot glances off the side of the backboard, and he banks in a corner three. And I remember and no one believed that he did it on purpose. And all the coaches were saying, "Oh, you didn't call bank." And he pointed at me, and I kind of remember going, "Wow, if he can intentionally bank in a three from the corner, maybe he's pretty good." Obviously, some of that in jest. But at what point do you remember, not just Paul but Lance, starting to think that maybe this draft duo could be really special?
Well, clearly with Paul, it was once Frank Vogel assumed the head coaching duties midway through that 2010-11 season, when the Pacers decided to cut their ties with Jim O'Brien and move Frank Vogel up a seat, because Paul was not playing a lot under Jim O'Brien. And you know, Jim wasn't really a fan favorite of rookies. He felt rookies had to pay their dues. And there were a number of times, Pat, that during the course of that season, Paul never got off the bench. But once Frank assumed control, you know, Paul started to play more of a role. And we saw that role, I think, flourish then in the playoff series with Chicago. Lance, it took a little bit longer. You know, Lance that first year played 12 games. Even in his second year, he only played 42 games and he started once. It really wasn't until, I think, year three when Lance started to come into his own. But you always saw that in the few minutes that Lance would get, even in late game situations where the game was either won or lost. I mean, he just played with an energy and with a fire and with a drive, and he wanted to compete. So he was a little bit behind Paul. But you could tell that this was going to be a duo that would be a key part of what the Pacers wanted to do.
The 2010-2011 season, the Pacers only won five more games than the year previous, but it did mean the playoffs, the eighth seed. Of course, it was the series against the Chicago Bulls. The Bulls won it 4-1. Every single one of those games was close, especially I remember game one, the Pacers led for a majority of it. Was that kind of a point, that first playoff series, when you realize, okay, this team's not good enough yet to beat Chicago, but maybe this is the first sign that the Pacers are building something serious?
No question about that, Pat. And I think even though you were 8 games under .500, there is a culture that you're trying to build as a franchise. And the culture is you want to play in postseason. And so even though Indiana, as the eighth seed, fell 4-1, you're right, they lose game one by 5, they lose game two by 6, they lose game three at Bankers Life Fieldhouse by 4, they finally win game four, a 5-point win, and then I thought they ran out of steam. In game five, it was all Chicago. But I think for the young players, for somebody like Paul George, it showed him what the postseason is about. And I think that's why we always talk in the NBA, why is it important to make the playoffs? Even if you're the 7th and 8th seed and nobody gives you a chance to compete against the 1 or the 2, it's all about building a framework and a culture for your basketball franchise that gives players a taste of what the postseason is like. And so there's no question that maybe the Pacers, if they don't make the playoffs that year, Pat, maybe they aren't as successful the next year. Maybe they're not as successful 2 years from now. But I think that season helped lay the framework for what the Pacers wanted to try to accomplish in the next few years.
In a lot of ways, and one of those you mentioned him a moment ago, Frank Vogel takes over in the interim in that 2010-2011 season. Were you surprised at all that he was then Larry Bird's choice to go forward permanently?
Well, I think when you're hired back in late January and your team is languishing and you tell the media that this is a playoff team and we're going to make the playoffs, I think we were all doubtful, if not skeptical. And then yet a few months later, here you are as the number 8 seed and you are going to the postseason. And I think Frank gave the team and the franchise some energy that was lacking in the prior few seasons. Even though he was Jim O'Brien's right-hand man, when he became the coach, he made a lot of changes. He didn't just do the same things that Jim O'Brien was doing. He did a lot of different things. And I think he created a lot of positivity. Jim O'Brien was more of an old school coach that I think at times relied more on the negative in how he dealt with players. And Frank changed that, you know, he flipped it around 180. And so I think what Frank proved in those final 20-plus games of the regular season, 30-plus games, whatever it was, and then in the postseason, I think Larry Bird felt confident that he was the guy to continue to build with this franchise.
You look at that starting five that had so much success for multiple seasons. Paul George and Lance Stephenson were part of the early decade draft. The following year, the Pacers trade in the draft for George Hill, and they sign David West. Let's start first with George Hill, because he was clearly a pillar of the successful teams. What do you remember about draft night? This is clearly a local kid who had been in San Antonio, one of Greg Popovich's favorite players. To be able to get him, the pick obviously turns into Kawhi Leonard, a player the Pacers probably aren't drafting, but to be able to get a player of Hill's caliber at that pick, was it completely opposite maybe to the year before when people are going, who? This was a known commodity both because of his local success and his success in the NBA.
No question about that, and I think you know, George had had good success at San Antonio coming off the bench. He was a guard, not a true point guard, not necessarily a two guard, but somebody you could stick out there whether as a backup, as a sixth man, or as a starter. And for most of that season, he was a backup. Remember, this was the lockout shortened season, so it was only a 66-game schedule. And, you know, George, for the most part, came off the bench in the regular season. He only started 9 games. He averaged about 10 points per game. But I think what Larry Bird was looking for was leadership. And he knew that George had learned a lot at San Antonio, learned a lot from Tony Parker, from Tim Duncan, from Manu Ginobili, the relationship he had with Greg Popovich, and they were, the Pacers were trying to rebuild a winning culture, and you wanted somebody like George Hill. It made a lot of sense. He was a hometown hero, if you will, having played at Broad Ripple and IUPUI. And, you know, everybody can talk about what Kawhi Leonard's become. Nobody knew that Kawhi Leonard would do what he was going to do. I'm not even sure San Antonio realized that. I think the advantage that Kawhi Leonard had was he was going to an established franchise in San Antonio that had won multiple championships. That's what the Pacers wanted from George Hill, somebody that had been around a franchise that had won multiple championships, and that's what I think George brought as his biggest asset.
David West comes in that offseason as well. Throughout the Pacers' history, they've almost entirely built on the draft and through trades. David West was someone who didn't necessarily fit that mold. A pretty big-name free agent comes in, and you talk about experience, leadership that George Hill had and brought from San Antonio. That was clearly, I would guess, one of the main attributes that Larry Bird liked the most in David West.
Yeah, he was somebody that with Chris Paul had played very well in New Orleans. He was coming in off an injury. Really, the lockout helped David West because he had suffered that injury and he was able to play all 66 games. And so if the lockout wouldn't have happened, he probably would have missed time in October and November. But since the season started a little bit differently, that was a great opportunity, for David West to come in and bring some leadership skills that, again, this young Pacers group was lacking. You had Paul George, you had Roy Hibbert. You had a guy in Danny Granger who had been around the franchise a little bit, but Danny had never been a part, really, of a winning culture. So I think the addition of David West and George Hill was huge for this franchise because what they brought not just on the floor, but off the floor.
That season, you mentioned it's the lockout shortened season. They go 42-24. It's a pretty significant jump from eighth in the East previously to third in the East. Yet I think somewhat still an unknown commodity. The team is very early in its successful period. They beat the Magic, who were shorthanded in the first round fairly easily, 4-1. Then comes this first of 3 years consecutively of playing the Miami Heat. The Pacers in that Heat series get up 2-1. Going into the series and then early into that series, was this maybe sort of the area, the point in time where you realize, okay, not only are the Pacers improved, but maybe they're going to be a real threat not only this season, but for years going forward?
Yeah, and I think the fan base started to feel, you know, with gold outs and all those kinds of things, that this could be a special time. Now, you knew in that first playoff series you're dealing with a Miami franchise that now has a big three. They've got LeBron James. They've got Chris Bosh. They have Dwayne Wade. They had won a title. They won a title, you know, with Wade and Shaq back in 06. But I think it gave the fans in Indianapolis, it gave the overall franchise a belief that, hey, the Pacers are back. The Pacers are back to their winning ways. And, you know, let's see what we can do.
Then you move forward to the next season. The Pacers win 49 games. They go 49-32. Again, they're third in the Eastern Conference. The Pacers go into the playoffs having dropped 5 of 6 that season and finish 49-32. They beat the Hawks in 6 games and then head to this playoff series against New York. Before we talk about the playoff series, how key do you think continuity was to this season? Because as we mentioned, there was major movement the previous 2 years. Paul George, Lance Stephenson, Frank Vogel, they start to come in and become bigger players. Then the next year it's David West and it's George Hill. Is this a year more of where continuity starts to kick in, do you think?
Well, it was important, and they had to have some continuity because they had lost their leading scorer from the year before. Remember, Danny Granger played 5 games during the 2012-2013 season, and this is when Lance Stephenson had to step up and join that established starting lineup of Paul George, David West, George Hill, and Roy Hibbert. So there's no question, Pat, that the continuity was important, especially when you lose a player of the caliber of Danny Granger's talent. So Tyler Hansbrough was an integral part coming off the bench for that team. So, yeah, no question, continuity was very important for this group.
That Knicks series, the Pacers don't have home court advantage, but steal game one in New York and then split the 2 games in New York. They then win the 2 games back at Bankers Life Fieldhouse to go up 3-1. Drop game 5. Game 6, essentially going into that game, did you feel like this was for the series? The Pacers have home court. Game 6 to try to close it out, and if they lose it, they have to go back to New York and try to win there. Obviously an unfavorable scenario if they aren't to win Game 6.
Yeah, you didn't want to have to go back to Madison Square Garden and face Carmelo and company in a Game 7. You can think back to the 90s and all the great playoff series between the Pacers and the Knicks, and you knew it would be very tough. You felt like the Pacers had won the game they needed to win in that Game 1, and Game 6 was fantastic. You know, for me, as a Pacers broadcaster, and again, not getting to do the game, but doing post-game shows after and being involved, that was as good an environment as you'll see. And just to be a part of it, just to see all the fans in their gold attire. I've always said, Pat, there is nothing better than the month of May with it's the Indianapolis 500, and it's Pacers basketball. It's Pacers and Racers, and there's just no question that Pacers-Knicks rivalry added fuel to the fire. You needed to win Game 6, hold home court, and get to the Eastern Conference Finals, and that's exactly what the Pacers did.
This playoff series, maybe the biggest series that the Pacers won during this run, they had so many battles with LeBron and the Heat, but this series has a moment which maybe sticks out amongst all playoff moments in 2010. I'm curious to get your thoughts. One playoff moment, does Roy Hibbert's block on Carmelo stick out amongst the rest to you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I still have that saved on my phone. That was all over Twitter and social media back then. I also remember, I hesitate to think what game it was. Lance Stephenson had some incredible plays in that series. He had a three-point play, I think, turned into a four-point play. And I just remember all the fans over in the corner opposite the Knicks bench that, you know, were cheering him on. And just so many great plays. But clearly Roy's block at the rim in a critical situation against Carmelo is a play that I think Pacers fans will always remember.
Then they play the Heat again, this time in the Eastern Conference Finals. One thing that stuck out to me about this series is how well the Pacers played in Miami in Games 1 and 2. They lose Game 1 in overtime. Game 2, they end up winning. This series goes to 7. Of course, Miami ends up taking it. Those first couple games in Miami, do you think they were integral to the confidence the Pacers needed to potentially pull out the series?
Yeah, and you go back to that Game 1, and you know Frank Vogel and Roy Hibbert talk about it all the time, that Frank had taken Roy off the floor at the end of regulation, and LeBron made the critical drive that tied it, forced overtime, and then the Pacers lose. But they had a lot of confidence, and they showed that. What was most disappointing is to go back to Indiana 1-1 and then have LeBron and Dwayne Wade go absolutely crazy in the second half of Game 3. You had to win Game 4 to even the series. The problem was at that point, Pat, you knew it was going to be tough to beat Miami again at home. And Game 7 was difficult to handle. The Pacers, I thought the environment got them. I thought LeBron and company played well, and you came up short. But for the second year in a row, you knew that you were one of the best teams in the NBA, and you were just hoping that moving forward to the next year, you might get that chance again.
Which was the main focus, I think, of that next season. Okay, we need to get home court. We need to be the number one overall seed. The Pacers go 56-26 in that season. It was a lot more interesting than that. They come out to the hot start, struggle a little bit toward the end of the season. What do you remember the most about a season which 56 wins? It's one of the best in Pacers history. Yet it felt to me at least like it had many different themes as you went through it.
Yeah, I was just looking at, ironically, I was just looking at the media guide today, and Pacers start out, 9-0. I think they're 16-1. At one point, they're 33-7. And they're 40-10, and then hit a little bit of a wall in early March. They had a three-game road trip where they lost at Charlotte, Houston, and Dallas. They started to struggle on the road in March. They had been a really good road team earlier in the year and just sort of struggled down the stretch, but still were able to hold off Miami for that one seed, and that was very important. But then it was Atlanta in the first round, and they had Pero Antic, who was creating all kinds of problems for Roy Hibbert, a 6'11 big man who could stretch the floor. I remember going to Game 6, and I'll fast forward to that. So after, you know, Pacers clinched home court advantage throughout the East, they're 56-26, and they go to Atlanta, having to play the eighth seed. And you knew that Atlanta was better than an 8 seed. And I remember going to Atlanta, Pat. Pacers are down 3-2. And every person in the NBA's national media was there because they were ready to write the story on what happened to the Pacers. The number one seed, they get beaten Game 6. Well, it didn't happen. They were down. And that was a game that I felt that David West willed the Pacers to the victory. They win 95-88. After that, I thought, there's no chance that the Pacers will lose Game 7, and they didn't. But it was the great escape, if you will. And it was what you were seeing was almost how the NBA was changing to where we are today, Pat, because from the year prior when Roy Hibbert was dominant, averaging 20 points and 10 rebounds in the series with Miami, all of a sudden Atlanta and Washington, with the way they were spreading the floor, they were taking Roy out of the equation. So those first two playoff series almost were showing us how the NBA was going to change moving forward.
They go to the Eastern Conference Finals again. They play the Miami Heat again. This time they have home court advantage, the Pacers do, and they win game one. Game two was close down the stretch. Miami ends up taking it. Do you think that was the key game in this series as Miami takes home court back?
Yeah, because the previous series, Indiana was not the higher seed, and so they were able to steal one of the first two games on the road in Miami. Now it was the Heat that had stolen a game, and I thought it was going to be very difficult because now the Heat were in the driver's seat. And, you know, this is a team that had won a couple of championships, and Pacers get beat by 12 in Game 3. They get beat by 12 in Game 4. Now their backs are to the wall. They have to win Game 5. You know, you're down 3-1. You've got to win three straight. They were able to win Game 5, and then Game 6 was like Game 7 the year prior. They almost were never in it. And so even though you got to back-to-back Eastern Conference Finals, that was disappointing because, as you said, the year before you had not had home court advantage, and you thought, gee, if you can just get home court advantage, maybe you'd have a chance to win the series. Well, the Pacers got home court advantage but came up short once again.
And then a moment in the next offseason, the Pacers have gone to two consecutive Eastern Conference Finals. Paul George is playing in a scrimmage for Team USA, and he breaks his leg. That's one of those moments I'm sure you remember exactly where you were when that moment happened.
Yeah, I was at Chase Field in Phoenix, Arizona on a road trip with the Indiana Fever, and I was sitting down the third base line, and ironically, I had my phone in my pocket, but Kevin Messenger, the PR director for the Fever, had his phone out and turned to me on, saw it on Twitter and said, "Hey, Paul George got hurt in Vegas." And I just sort of poo-pooed him. I said, "Oh, Price sprained his ankle or something." And then all of a sudden, I pulled my phone out and Twitter was blowing up. And then my wife called me, and then you found out how bad it was. And that had come on the heels of Lance Stephenson deciding that he was going to turn down the Pacers and go to the Charlotte Hornets. And now you weren't going to have Paul. And it was like the Beatles were breaking up, right? I mean, even though it was you thought this team had another chance. I mean, you still thought they had another chance, what they had learned the last 3 years. So how quickly things can change, and a lot changed that day, that night in Las Vegas.
The Pacers rather impressively still put together 38 wins, which was actually the number needed to get into the playoffs. They just lost the tiebreaker that year, finishing in ninth the following season, 45-37. They give the Raptors 7 games in the first round of the playoffs. This season, around 500, the story's yet to be completely written. As you look forward, we're talking 2010s decade, so we're in the present of it. We'll be in the 2010s for another few years. What do you see as the future when you look forward? An open-ended question, maybe one that's tough to answer.
Yeah, I mean, what I do see, Pat, is an overall framework for a franchise. I mean, even though the last 3 years have been difficult and you've been right around 500, you were under 500 a couple of years ago, didn't make the playoffs. You were 45-37 a year ago. And as we speak, you're a couple of games under 500. The last 3 years has been basically a 500 basketball team. And that's been tough because we know what those previous 3 years were. But I still think as you look back over the years of Pacers basketball, as we celebrate this 50th year and we're into the final decade of the 50 years, what the Pacers have done, 21 of the last 27 years in the playoffs. I think so many teams across this league would trade places with this franchise. And though it doesn't have an NBA title like the Cavaliers or the Heat or the Celtics here, recently, I think the Milwaukees, the Atlantas, the Charlottes, there are tons of franchises that look at the history, the recent history, and even this decade, they would trade with the Pacers. So hopefully that's what happens again for Indiana. Even though there's been a little bit of a lull and the Pacers have played 500 basketball, I have a firm belief that it doesn't take a lot to get back there. And just as you said, that was a four-year period where you were averaging, 33, 34 wins. And then all of a sudden in a four-year period, you win 65% of your games and go to two Eastern Conference finals. So I think it shows that it can happen very quickly. And I'm looking forward to that as we complete this decade of the 2010s.
And the 2010s decade will be celebrated on April 4th. The Pacers host the Toronto Raptors. Pacers.com/tickets is how you can be there. Every fan in attendance will receive a Paul George bobblehead. Pacers TV play-by-play voice, Chris Denary, appreciate your insights.
All right, thanks, Pat.